Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Ana Mateo, as well as a story from Jonathan Evans about a very special Sudanese athlete. Later, Shirley Griffith, Larry West, and Steve Ember bring us the latest in the ongoing American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver present the Higher Education Report, which looks at the U.S. higher education system's historical connection with slavery.
American colleges and universities are increasingly discussing the idea of reparations linked to their historical ties to slavery. Until now, schools have created monuments, changed building names, and issued public apologies instead of providing money. But Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and two other colleges recently announced financial commitments to people whose ancestors were slaves. The year 2019 marks the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first slave in what is now the American state of Virginia. The United States has been discussing reparations since slavery officially ended in 1865.
But there is increasing attention to the slave economy wealth of American colleges and universities. Jeffrey Clinton is a student at the University of Buffalo in New York. He said he thinks colleges should admit to their historical ties to slavery. But he also thinks the federal government should take the lead on an issue that reaches well beyond higher education. It doesn't have to be trillions of dollars, but at least address the inequities and attack the racial wealth gap between African Americans and white Americans, and really everybody else, because this is an American-made institution. We didn't immigrate here, said Clinton, whose ancestors were slaves. A majority of Georgetown undergraduate students voted in April to pay an additional $27 a semester as a reconciliation contribution. The money would support projects in poor communities where some descendants of slaves sold in 1838 live today. The 272 slaves were sold to help pay Georgetown's debts.
Georgetown President John DeGioia announced a university-led reparations effort in October. His goal is to raise about $400,000 from donors to support projects like health clinics and schools in those same communities. At least 56 universities have joined a University of Virginia-led group called Universities Studying Slavery. The schools aim to explore their ties to slavery and share research and suggestions for how to settle the past wrongdoing. In recent years, some schools, like Yale University, have removed the names of slavery supporters from buildings. New monuments have gone up at other places including Brown University's Slavery Memorial Sculpture and the University of Virginia's Memorial to Enslaved Laborers, which is still being built. In September, Virginia Theological Seminary announced a $1.7 million fund in recognition of slaves who worked there. It said the money would be used to support African American clergy in the Episcopal Church and programs that promote justice and inclusion. The Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey followed with a $27.6 million fund after a historical study found that some of its creators used slave labor. Its president, M. Craig Barnes, said the seminary would not avoid addressing difficult truths about its history.
In an October letter to Harvard University's president, Antigua and Barbuda's prime minister noted the developments at Georgetown and the seminaries. Gaston Brown asked the school to consider how it could amend for the oppression of Antiguan slaves by a slave owner whose gift supported a law professorship in 1815. Harvard's president answered with a promise that the school would explore its historical ties to slavery. People have also urged the University of Buffalo to consider the beliefs and actions of its founder, Millard Fillmore. As America's 13th president, Fillmore signed the Fugitive Slave Act to help slave owners reclaim escaped slaves. Students at the University of Buffalo have not officially raised the idea of reparations, a school spokesman told the Associated Press. But students did lead a discussion on the issue as part of Black Solidarity Week last month. Few Americans support reparations. A recent public opinion study showed that only 29% of those questioned said the government should pay reparations to descendants of enslaved Black people. University of Buffalo Associate Professor Keith Griffler specializes in African and African American studies. He said he sees the beginning of a movement at schools of higher learning. Griffler said, "The conversations, just acknowledging these kinds of things, I think would go a long way toward making students feel that at least their voices are being heard." I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Americans often try to say things as quickly as possible. So, for some expressions, we use the first letters of the words instead of saying each word. Many common expressions or long names are shortened this way. BYOB is a short way of saying, "bring your own bottle." The letters BYOB are often found at the bottom of a written invitation to a simple social event or gathering of friends. For example, let's say I had a New Year's Eve party. I might include on the invitation, "please come to my party," and BYOB. The bottle each person brings is what the person wants to drink at the party or wants to share. However, an invitation to a special event, such as a wedding, would never say BYOB. An invitation to an official or very special event often has other letters written at the bottom. The letters are RSVP. These letters represent the French expression, Répondez s'il vous plaît. In English, the words mean, respond if it pleases you. Americans use the letters as a short way to say, please answer this invitation. Another expression, usually used for business and not parties, is ASAP. So a colleague might say she needs something done ASAP. It means as soon as possible. She might also need to have something done by COB. That means she wants to finish it by close of business or the end of the workday. Beginning letters are often used to represent the names of universities. A famous one is MIT. That is short for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Another major university is UCLA. Almost no one ever says its real name, the University of California at Los Angeles. That takes way too long. Many American government agencies are also known by their beginning letters. For example, the FBI is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The FBI investigates criminal activity in the United States. Then there is the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. It is not a very popular agency because it collects federal taxes. And that's all for Voice of America's Words and Their Stories. Or maybe I should just say VOA's What's. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Wheelchair basketball is becoming more popular in South Sudan. The sport offers hope for athletes with disabilities. Some lost their legs from unexploded bombs left from decades of conflict. U.S. professional wheelchair basketball players recently helped 80 South Sudanese players in a week-long training program and competition. Among them was Malat Way, a Sudanese-American wheelchair athlete. Wei was 3 years old and living in South Sudan when he lost the use of his legs to the polio disease. Wei lived in a refugee camp for several years. When he was 12, his family moved to the United States. He later played wheelchair basketball at the University of Arizona. In December, he returned to South Sudan as a role model for other disabled athletes.
I went through the same situation that these athletes are going through. So as a me, coming back, it's a hope for them, saying that there's someone that actually care about us.
Wei helped train 80 South Sudanese wheelchair basketball players for a two-day competition in Juba. The International Committee of the Red Cross and the South Sudan Wheelchair Basketball Association organized the training. Wei says that in 2 years, the number of wheelchair basketball players in the country has more than doubled. In 2019, 15 women were included for the first time. Anna Doki Gabriel had never played basketball before. She told VOA, "For me, as a person in a wheelchair, basketball has really made me feel that we can do something just like able-bodied people." South Sudan has more than 1.2 million people with disabilities. Jess Markt is the Disability and Inclusion Advisor for the ICRC. He has trained wheelchair teams in Afghanistan, the Middle East, and South America. He says the training helps to change harmful opinions people may have about those with disabilities.
Once they start to have that confidence in themselves and they start to realize that maybe what they've always been told about what their place in society should be is not what their place in society should be. They should expect more from themselves and from the society around them.
Wei says inclusion and acceptance is not the only thing the athletes learn.
These athletes, they're all from different tribes, from different backgrounds. But when they come to the basketball court, the sport just brings this joy of all the South Sudanese uniting together and to collaborate and to work together as a one country.
I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the late 1800s, white Americans expanded their settlements in the western part of the country. They claimed land traditionally used by American Indians. The Indians were hunters, and they struggled to keep control of their hunting lands. The federal government supported the settlers' claims. It fought and won several wars with Indian tribes. It forced the Indians to live on government-controlled reservations. Larry West and Steve Ember tell about the people who settled on the old Indian lands after the wars.
After the Indians were defeated, thousands of settlers hurried west. Some hoped to find new, rich farmland. The soil they left behind was thin and overworked. Their crops were poor. Some simply hoped to buy any kind of farmland. They did not have enough money to buy farmland in the East. Others came from other countries and hoped to build new lives in the United States. All the settlers found it easy to get land in the West. In 1862, Congress had passed the Homestead Act. This law gave every citizen and every foreigner who asked for citizenship the right to claim government land. The law said each man could have 65 hectares. If he built a home on the land and farmed it for 5 years, it would be his. He paid just $10 to record the deal.
Claiming land on the Great Plains was easy. Building a farm there and working it was not so easy. The wide, flat grasslands seemed strange to men who had lived among the hills and forests of the East. Here there were few hills or trees. Without trees, settlers had no wood to build houses. Some built houses partly underground. Others built houses from blocks of earth cut out of the grassland. These houses were dark and dirty. They leaked and became muddy when it rained. There were no fences on the Great Plains, so it was hard to keep animals away from crops.
Settlers in the American West also had a problem faced by many people in the world today. They had little fuel for heating and cooking. With few trees to cut for fuel, they collected whatever they could find. Small woody plants, dried grass, cattle and buffalo wastes. Water was hard to find, too. And although the land seemed rich, it was difficult to prepare for planting. The grass roots were thick and strong. They did not break apart easily. The weather also was a problem. Sometimes months would pass without rain, and the crops would die. Winters were bitterly cold.
Most of the settlers, however, were strong people. They did not expect an easy life. And as time passed, they found solutions to most of the problems of farming on the Great Plains. Railroads were built across the West. They brought wood for homes, wood and coal for fuel. Technology solved many of the problems. New equipment was invented for digging deep wells. Better pumps were built to raise the water to the surface. Some of the pumps used windmills for power.
The fence problem was solved in 1874. That was the year barbed wire was invented. The sharp metal barbs tore the skin of the men who stretched it along fence tops, but they prevented cattle from pushing over the fences and destroying crops. New farm equipment was invented. This included a plow that could break up the grassland of the plains. And farmers learned techniques for farming in dry weather.
Most of the problems on the plains could be solved, but solving them cost money. A farmer could get wood to build his house, but he had to buy the wood and pay the railroad to bring it west. To farm the plains, he needed barbed wire for fences and plows and other new equipment. All these things cost money. So a plains farmer had to grow crops that were in big demand. He usually put all his efforts into producing just one or two crops.
The farmers of the plains did well at first. There was enough rain. Huge crops of wheat and corn were produced. Much of the grain was sold in Europe, and farmers got good prices. The farmers, however, were not satisfied. They were angry about several things. One was the high cost of sending their crops to market. The only way to transport their grain was by railroad, and railroad prices were very high for farm products, higher than for anything else. The railroads also owned the big buildings where grain was stored. Farmers had to pay to keep their grain there until it was sold. They said storage costs were too high.
The farmers were angry about the high cost of borrowing money, too. They opposed the import taxes, tariffs they had to pay on foreign products. Some of the tariffs were as high as 60%. Congress had set the levels high to protect American industry from foreign competition. But farmers said they were the victims of this policy because it increased their costs. Farmers, as individuals, could do nothing to change the situation. But if they united in a group, they thought, perhaps they could influence government policy.
Farmers began to unite in local, social, and cultural groups called granges. As more and more farmers joined granges, the groups began to act on economic problems. Farmers organized cooperatives to buy equipment and supplies in large amounts directly from factories. The cost of goods was lower when bought in large amounts. The granges also began to organize for political action. Local granges became part of the national grange movement. Grange supporters won control of state legislatures in a number of Middle Western states. They passed laws to limit the cost of railroad transportation and crop storage. Railroads refused to obey these laws. They fought the measures in the courts. They did not win. Finally, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
The railroads said the laws were not constitutional because they interfered with the right of Congress to control trade between the states. The railroads said states could not control transportation costs. To do so would reduce profits for the railroad, and that would be the same as taking property from the railroad without legal approval. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. In a decision in 1876, the Supreme Court said states had a legal right to control costs of railroad transportation. It said owners of property in which the public has an interest must accept public control for the common good. The farmers seem to have won, but the powerful railroad companies continued to struggle against controls. They reduced some transportation costs, but only after long court fights.
The granges tried to get Congress to pass laws giving the federal government power to control the railroads. Congress refused to act. Many farmers lost hope that the granges could force the railroads to make any real cuts in their costs. They began to leave the organization. Others left because the economy had improved. They no longer felt a need to protest. Within a few years, the National Grange had lost most of its members. Some local groups continued to meet, but they took no part in politics. New protest groups would be formed in a few years when farmers once again faced hard times. But for now, in the late 1870s, times were good. Most people were satisfied.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. And find more stories, quizzes, and English learning activities, including videos and lessons, on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.